Actually, it was quite interesting hearing Beth talk about university and doubts and things, because that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today. And I think it's something that we don't talk enough about in church. There's kind of an assumption that we've all got it sorted. And therefore, if we're going to talk about it not being sorted, that's a bad thing. And I think that's not good. We need to talk about the times where we're really struggling, because actually that's when we need it a lot more. So just a couple of questions for everybody. Just stick your hands up. You don't have to shout out. But who here believes in God? Well, that's a good start, at least. Who here believes that Jesus is the Son of God and he came to save us? Yeah, this is looking good. I'm doing well. Okay, who's believed for 5 years or less? Okay. Do I need to reword that for you, Luke? Okay, up more than 10 years? 10 years or more? Excellent. All your life? Okay, so how many of you here have ever doubted God's existence or his methods? Okay, how many of you have doubted elements of your faith? Okay, so I'm not alone, and neither are you, which is great. Now, today, if we were in a church, the church that I grew up in, a Catholic church, they'd be reading the bit of John where they talk about... this isn't working, or I'm pressing the wrong button. Thomas. And I think it's quite apt that I'm going to talk about this. I've been thinking about talking about doubt for an awful long time. It's something that's quite personal to me. But so... It's about a week after Jesus' resurrection, or a few days, and he's appeared to a few people, but one time he appears to the disciples, Thomas isn't there. So now Thomas, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord," but he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Oh, wrong button. I'll get the hang of this by the end of it. So... here we've got Thomas. Now, he's been with Jesus for the last 3 years. He knows what he said. He's seen the miracles. And yet, even though Jesus has told him everything that was going to happen, he still can't believe it. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd like to think that after hearing 3 years of preaching from Jesus, I'd know what's going to happen. Yet, Thomas, who actually went on to spread the message around Asia, doubts at that crucial moment. But Jesus doesn't sort of rebuke him for doubting. He gives him what he needs so that he can believe. He turns up and he says, "Look, put your hand here, put your hand in my side. You can see it, you can feel it, you know it is real." So I think we all have those moments like Thomas. And there's more than just Thomas in the Bible. In fact, it goes right back to Genesis. There are people not believing it right back in Genesis. Oh, I'll press the right button in a minute. So we go back even to Abraham, the father of Judaism, so to speak, who God comes to and says, "Look, you may be old, but you're going to have a child, and they're going to father all the... you're going to be the father of great nations." And he laughs. God also said to Abram, "As for Sarah, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarah. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her." Abraham fell face down. He laughed and said to himself, "Will a son be born to a man of 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? He's laughing at God. You know, he can't believe it. And there are others as well. Gideon, who is told by God that he is going to save Israel. And he says, Gideon said to God, "I will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, Look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me. Let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time, make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew." That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. Gideon is still not convinced after one miracle, so he has to test God again. But in both the examples, God doesn't rebuke them or go and choose somebody else. He gives them what they need to believe. I've got the wrong title in there. So we go back into the New Testament right at the beginning. So apologies for the reference, I've copied and pasted. So this is right at the beginning where God is telling Zechariah that his wife Elizabeth is going to have a son. And again, much like Abraham, he does the same thing. He's like, "But the angel said to him, 'Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. He will be a joy and a delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born. He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and to the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure of this? I am an old man, and my wife is well along in years." The angel said to him, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and tell you this good news. And now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their appointed time." So the Bible is full of examples of people who, like us, have doubts, like us, have concerns about how God is going to do things and what God is going to do. So, and we should take great courage and encouragement from that. If it was full of really holy people who got it right all the time, it would be even harder, I think, to struggle with our doubts. So Beth mentioned about university and how difficult it can be to have faith at university. And I think that's because with science and things, we're constantly bombarded in today's world about the reasons not to believe. I found a couple of headlines. New theory could prove how life began and disprove God. These are the kind of things that we see all around us on social media, in the news. Or Big Bang, is there room for God? The media and those with loud voices like to tell us how wrong we are. And in James chapter 1, and I've spoken about James before, but I think he's the most pragmatic of the New Testament writers, and I think that really helps. And he says this, "If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do." Now, I think that does sound a little bit like a rebuke for having doubts. But I don't think that's quite what he means. What I think he is trying to say is if you are having doubts, you need to ask God and he will help you. Not rely on your own research or your own investigations to try and find out what God is saying or whether he really exists. It's about asking God to help you believe. And we get a really good example of this in Mark, where Jesus heals a boy prone to fits. And Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." And immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." And I think this is where we struggle with it, and that is that we see all these miracles or we read about them in the Bible, but can we truly believe that they will happen to us. I think that's often the case. It was great to hear what Carl said earlier, where, you know, we say these prayers and we hope that they're going to be fulfilled. But somehow, deep down in our human mind, perhaps we doubt that it will really happen, or we find a justification that it wasn't really God, it was something else, it was a bit of luck or whatever. And I think that's what Jesus is saying there, and what this man is asking. He's saying, help me believe that it can happen to me. This is the hard bit of my sermon, because I'm going to kind of talk about me and my doubts. So please bear with me a bit. So I was born into a Christian home. My family are Catholic. My nan is from Irish Catholic stock, and I grew up in a Catholic family, and we went to church every Sunday. All my life, I never doubted it at all. You know, I was baptized at Portsmouth Cathedral when I was about 6 weeks old. We moved to Cornwall. That's the bottom picture there. And went to church every Sunday at St. Mary's Helston, which is a little church. My dad played in the worship band there. And we were there for, well, I did my Holy Communion there when I was about 8. And then at 9, I went away to boarding school at Buckfast Abbey, which is at the top. I became an altar boy while I was there, which meant that you helped out on Sundays, but the other advantage of it was also that if there was a holy day of obligation during the week, or a ordination, things like that, you got to go and have breakfast in the monks' refectory. And I tell you what, they ate well. It was great. And you got out of lessons as well, which was even better. And in the last year, we did lessons to learn more about our faith, and there was a retreat, and then I was confirmed, which is basically where I made those promises that my parents had made at my baptism to say, I believe in this. A bit like we do baptism in your teens, so I was 13. And then after Buckfast, I went on to Downside, another Benedictine school, in Stratton-on-Foss. That's a picture of it all. So it was quite big. There were 400 odd boys, and we were taught by the monks. We had to go to school every Sunday morning, and any holy days of obligation, so the 1st of November, there were lots. And also house masses, where I was in Caverill, and our house would have a mass once a term. So faith was very much part of my schooling and my life at home. And I didn't doubt, and I was very confident in what I believed. Up until I was in the lower six, which I think is year 12 in modern terminology, when a guy I was at prep school with and had shared a dormitory with was killed outside, that's the Abbey Church there as well, this guy, a guy called Julian Elwell, who was killed in a car crash just up the road from here. And at Malvern College, he was 17 years old, he'd not long passed his driving test, and he'd been jilted by a girlfriend and gone out into Malvern and got drunk and drove a car. Now, it seems daft thinking about it now, because it was the consequences of his stupidity. But at the time, when I was 17 years old and all these things are coming in as you grow up, I started to blame God. I said, you know, why couldn't you stop him getting in the car? Why didn't it just not start? You know, you're God, you can stop these things. So if he didn't stop a friend of mine dying, you know, and then you start seeing all the news about these disasters, you know, God, why are you being so unkind to this world? Is what was going through my head. Now, I don't think I ever stopped believing that God existed. What I did start believing was that God was not very nice, and I didn't want any part of it. If that was God, you can get lost. So I stopped going to communion. I couldn't get out of going to church. I'd have got in trouble because we had to be there at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And if you weren't, someone would come and find you in your room and drag you there. So I had to be there, but I stopped taking communion. It was my little rebellion against God. When I left school, I did stop going to church. and I didn't go to church for many years. Or if I did, it was with my family just because it was Christmas Day and it was the thing to do, but I wouldn't take communion. So I ended up at university, and as Beth mentioned, there are a lot of temptations at university. And if you haven't got a strong faith, it's very easy to get carried away with all the crazy fun and excitement of drinking and other recreational activities. But it meant that the decisions I was making were not good. And in the end, I dropped out of university. I ended up working in a pub and flitting from job to job. And it took a long time to realize that things were not going well, and it was an absence of a relationship with God. So in 2003, I met Lucy, and things started to change. But then in 2004, my nan, that's the University of Southampton now, my nan was diagnosed with cancer and died at 69. Now, much the same way that when my friend had died a few years before, I was, gosh, this isn't fair. You know, she's got 9 grandchildren, quite young. She's never going to see many. She saw one great-grandchild. She's now got 12, I think. But I thought it was unfair. And at her funeral, I was staying with my uncle and aunt in Roath. Lucy had come to the funeral with me. It was the first time she'd met my family, so she was incredibly brave. But she was staying at my aunt, another aunt and uncle's house, the other side of Cardiff in Pentwyn. And I was in the front room of my uncle and aunt's house after the funeral. And I knew that God was there, but I didn't understand anything. And one thing you have to understand when I say this is that growing up in the Catholic Church, the belief that we have is that when people die, if they believe in God, they go to heaven. And they're as alive in Christ as us in this room. So I can ask my nan to pray for me like I could ask Lou or Steve. So that night, I was lying in the room, and I said, "Nan, pray for me. I need to know why this has happened." I still don't know why it's happened. But what I felt was an incredible peace that one day I would understand. And from that moment on, it still took a bit of time, but it was the turning point, and it brought me back to God, and it ended up bringing us here. And I think in the same way that when Thomas had his doubts, Jesus gave him the means to stop doubting. Not understand everything, but stop doubting. And I think that night, that's what I got. It was just a piece that God has a plan and will let us, if we ask him to, we will feel confident enough in his plan that we won't doubt. We won't doubt, of course we'll doubt, but that we'll be able to get through that doubt. And that one day, everything will make sense. So eventually in 2008, we ended up coming to Forest Gate, and although it was very odd for me at first, as you've seen the churches that I was used to from growing up, this is very different. But over that time, being able to talk to people in the church, it's become, my faith has come back and grown stronger. And that's because I've been able to talk to people and ask people. And I think it's all well and good me standing here and saying, look, there's all these people in the Bible that have doubts. I've got a story of doubt and coming back to God. I don't have a sort of massive Damascene moment that did it, but just gradual. So I think what would be important is, what can we do if we have doubts? When I was talking to Steve the other day about this sermon, he mentioned about there's a new film coming out called Tolkien, about J.R.R. Tolkien, who's one of the principal people responsible for C.S. Lewis coming to Christianity. And we were looking at interesting quotes. I was going to show a clip of the film, but it didn't sort of help this, so I skipped it. But he did have a quote. And what he said was this, that the only cure for sagging or fainting faith is communion. Like the act of faith, it must be continuous and grow by exercise. Frequency is of the highest effect. 7 times a week is more nourishing than 7 times at intervals. Now, obviously, like me, he comes from a Catholic background, so what he understands of communion is probably slightly different. But I think the central point is the same. You cannot, if you are doubting, the worst thing you can do is to move away from your faith and your church and your communion and sharing in that remembrance of Jesus. I did it, and it took a long time to come back. And the longer you're away from it, the harder it is to come back. So if we are doubting or questioning or just feel put upon by the world, the best thing is to be at a church and able to talk to people, to share communion with people, to remember the amazing sacrifice that Jesus made that we celebrated last Sunday. When I was sort of researching this, and doubt has always been a big thing for me. It's something that affected me for a long time, and therefore I wanted to see what other people had said about it. And I found this article in the HuffPost by a guy called Jonathan Weyer. And he said this, because he was talking about his own doubts as well, so again, another person, I'm not alone, was how I was feeling. I have to say, rethinking how I approach questioning the Bible turned out to be harder than I thought. I had such an ingrained attitude driven by misquoted scripture. Didn't Jesus say we should have the faith of a child? It's true he did, but it's my belief we haven't really thought about his words. Have you ever been around kids? Kids do have a simple faith, but they also question everything. My kids ask intense questions like, why does God let people die? Why do I feel scared? Why was this person mean to me? I find it much easier to answer the questions of adults than kids. And I think we have to be willing to ask those questions, not hide away from them. We have to ask them. We have to ask each other, and we have to ask God what about those questions so that we can get his peace and understand what's going on.